This is an ABC podcast.
And on behalf of the entire LNL team, Giuseppe welcomes you to another year of the Little Wireless program. This is that time of the year when RN's programs return in, we hope, rebooted and reinvigorated. They hit the ground running. Well, in our case, we're going to hit the ground driving because we're going to join Laura Tingle. And how could we start the year in any other way than by having a mingle with Tingle? We're going to join her on Bill's bus in Bundaberg. You might recall that in November last year, Scott Morrison was out and about in a big blue bus in Queensland, got him into a spot of bother. And Bill is following in not so much his footsteps as his tire tread. So shortly, Laura, and together we shall try and predict what the hell might be happening in the year ahead. And then we will welcome back to the program Jason Sharman. Jason's a professor of international relations in the Department of Politics and International Studies at Cambridge and a fellow of King's College. He's one of us. He's an Australian who's done rather well for himself. And on this occasion, he's going to be joining us to argue that the Western dominance of the world over the last couple of centuries is an anomaly. It's not the way things have been or were for millennia, and not the way it will be in the future. But first of all, be upstanding. Laura, welcome to a new year. It's great to have you back.
Philip, it's lovely to be back.
Look, before we get stuck into what is a considerable amount of stuff we really must discuss, I must ask you, are you actually travelling on the bus?
I am actually travelling on the bus. We started out today on the Hong Kong coast, and I'm, as we speak, in the scenic city of Bundaberg tonight, and moving onwards tomorrow on the bus.
Who's on the bus with you, dare I ask?
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, his wife Chloe, their daughter Clementine, various staff members of said opposition leader, a few journalists, and me. Yeah, so it's not a full scale election bus, but it's a jolly little show.
We should point out, of course, that buses predate ScoMo. They've been a part of the American political tradition for generations.
Well, they have, and they are seen in Australian election campaigns as well. I suppose it's a little bit newer that they come out between election campaigns, but to me it's a natural extension of what's been happening for years, which is that John Howard essentially set up permanent campaigning, and so having a bus, which you would normally have an election campaign for the media and the leaders and things, is just an extension of that.
Can you put a couple more coins in your phone, because you're very muffled and waffly? And
I'm sorry. That might be me rather than the phone.
I think that sounds a little better. Well, first of all, Scott Morrison caught a bus to Fiji,
which is truly astonishing when you consider the landmasses and things involved. Yes, so Scott Morrison has started the year trying to make sure that everybody knew that he was still being Prime Minister, that he wasn't about to call the election, which a lot of people in Australia would prefer that he did, and went to Fiji and Vanuatu. And I think it was actually a really interesting trip, Philip. I mean, obviously the headline was that he got berated at some length in the Pacific about Australia's climate change policy, which is seeing large parts of the Pacific sort of sink slowly into the ocean. But I think the initiatives in Fiji were very interesting, given the fraught relationship that we have had and that the rest of the world has had with Fiji for much of the last few decades. There was a really large range of initiatives from education through to supporting what is, apart from anything else, quite a big cash cow for Fiji, which is peacekeeping operations. It's a really large rapprochement with Fiji, probably certainly the most significant since about 2000 and possibly the most significant since the first troubles in the late 1980s.
Laura, when famous explorers went to the Pacific, they always took with them trinkets, pocket knives, mirrors and beads. What pocket knives, mirrors and beads did ScoMo take?
Look, he took all sorts of things, Philip, and they weren't insubstantial things. I mean, there are a few things that sort of sound fairly trite to us. For example, there was something to do with rugby league, which I know that you're a major aficionado of, so I'll leave you to explain that to listeners. But sport does play a huge part in the Pacific, in society. And essentially, Scott Morrison announced something that would allow Fijians to take part in the New South Wales Rugby League competition. I think that's what it's called. So there were things like that, but there was more support for a base that is used to train train peacekeepers. There are a couple of more patrol boats to look at sort of border security and fishing rights and all those sorts of things. And behind all of this, of course, is this sort of renewed impetus on being friendly to our Pacific neighbours, because the Chinese have been particularly friendly in the last few years, and suddenly we look around with alarm and see the changing spheres of influence in the region.
Did he take with him a Melbourne-born terrorist? I'm raising the issue of Neil Prakash's citizenship.
No, he didn't. He didn't do that, Philip. He didn't do that. But
was it discussed?
I'm not aware that it was discussed. So you've got me on the hop there. But there were a lot of other things that were economically significant to Fiji, in particular the idea that Fiji could join the Pacific Labour Program that Australia runs, which allows people from the Pacific to come and work in Australia and repatriate funds back to their home countries, which of course is very important, and which was jeopardised last year. You may remember there was a sort of a decision to crack down on temporary visas, which was going to affect a lot of the countries like Vanuatu and other countries in the Pacific, which send workers to Australia for seasonal work. And suddenly the government decided, without really thinking it through, that they would kill this program, much to the ire not only of the Pacific nations but to the rural industries who depend on them.
Okay, let's look at Queensland, because it's amazing how prime ministers and opposition leaders are drawn to Queensland. Why the fascination?
There are just so many seats, Philip, and so many seats that are still up for grabs. Now there are some. We think of Queensland as being a very conservative state, of being sort of dominated by the old sort of Joe National Party. It's much more complicated than that. We're travelling in this next couple of days from seats which are really, really marginal to seats with 8% sort of margins in favour of the LNP, but which might be up for grabs, partly because of One Nation, amongst other factors. But there's six seats, I think, that Labor thinks that it might win, including Peter Dutton's seat of Dixon. There's seats down in around Brisbane, like Ford, held by Bert von Manen. And if you look at the trend in those seats in the last few years, the margin in favour of the LNP has just kept on being pared back and pared back.
But nonetheless, I remember last time people thought Dutton might be in trouble, but he did win by a useful margin. Is he in trouble now?
I think he's in really serious trouble now. And this was, of course, one of the reasons why the coup against Malcolm Turnbull took place. It came from Queensland. Peter Dutton, his colleague in the seat of Petrie, Luke Howarth, they all thought that they were going to lose their seats. They believed that their margins had been pared back because Malcolm Turnbull had done an abysmal job in 2016 and or because he was not going to be a Prime Minister who would ever attract a huge vote in Queensland. So they made the big push to put Peter Dutton in place. That all fell spectacularly short and they've ended up with Scott Morrison. So they've sort of ended up with neither fish nor fowl, and they are very, they're surprisingly narrow margins, Philip, to defend. And I think Peter Dutton in particular is in trouble in his seat. A lot of people didn't really focus on the fact that he was even their local member. I'm told by people who have been looking at all the numbers, and when he suddenly emerged as a potential prime ministerial candidate, they were saying, well, one, we didn't know he was our member, and two, what is he doing? We don't particularly like Malcolm Turnbull, but we don't want another prime ministerial scalp, thank you very much. So I think it's done him a lot of damage.
Sticking with the bus metaphor, I understand that the PM is going to load at least a metaphoric bus with cabinet ministers and have a cabinet meeting in Queensland.
That's right. The Prime Minister is heading for Cairns by himself tomorrow to make some announcements, which clearly are designed to sort of head off Bill Shorten at the pass, as he did in the Northern Territory about a week ago. And then Cabinet is going to convene in Queensland as well the following week, as I understand it, to sort of show how important Queensland is for them. And I think apart from anything else, Philip, one of the interesting things is that the seats open to Labor to win now are spread right across the country. I mean, Western Australia, where they never win seats, people are talking about four seats being in play in Western Australia. Victoria, massive numbers of seats in play in Victoria. But Queensland is a place where the coalition still believes that it can reap those votes and bring them back to the fold, hold on to them, hopefully hold off One Nation and sort of somehow hold on to government. But it seems to me a very grim hope.
This is the first live LNL for the year, and we're having a mingle with Tingle. On the news that preceded us, I heard that ScoMo is ridiculing Bill Shorten's decision to round up some quite significant scientific muscle to look at the fish kill. Is the Murray-Darling going to be a big issue?
Look, I think the Murray-Darling is really an interesting sort of metaphor for our political times. The coalition has not wanted to touch this issue. I mean, you've had these. It reminds me of the polar bear on the melting iceberg in 2007, when John Howard was refusing to deal with climate change. It's this image that everybody can grasp, and whatever your views on climate change or anything else, you just say something is going on here. Now, I think Bill Shorten's being quite smart about this. He's saying, and what he said in press conferences along the way today is, look, I don't know what's happening and why the fish kill is happening. It could be anybody's fault. There could be all sorts of factors. I just really want to find out, as Australian people do, why this has happened. So I asked the government whether they would set up a task force to look at this and was knocked back. So I've asked the Australian Academy of Science to do it now. The government is saying, look, this is just a stunt. It doesn't mean anything. Bill Shorten saying, well,
that is an idiotic response.
You could say that, but I couldn't possibly comment on it. I mean, I think the thing is, Bill Shorten saying, I think quite reasonably, look, I don't have any particular skin in this game, but I'd like to know what's actually happened. And when the Academy of Sciences, which you'd sort of think would be a vaguely reputable group, reports, we will just release the report. And that's a way of informing people, which is what politicians should do. And it will also, you know, in a pragmatic sense, keep the issue alive of what has been going on with our water licensing system and everything else.
I've got a message for Gladys and Potties and Tweet Arts. If you take out your dance card, we will be talking about the Murray Darling on Wednesday night with Professor Quentin Grafton from the ANU. Mind you, what the hell would he know? women, I know. Before we do women, let's do royal commissions. We've had the Royal Commission into banking, now it's aged care. Mm. How will the politics of this play out, Lord Attingle?
The politics of women?
The politics of aged care.
Oh, the politics of aged care. Well, look, I think the politics of aged care will be that it'll be a bit like the politics of the Banking Royal Commission. It'll mean that the government is in constant sort of defence mode about some revelation or be having to respond to some really atrocious revelation. It is a bit of a mystery to me, Philip, particularly given the demographic of Liberal voters, why they were sort of so dismissive of an aged care royal commission for so long, particularly given their experience with the Banking Royal Commission. But it's going to just be a sort of continual headache for the government because they're in power and everybody will blame them for whatever's going on. But I think it will also frame and inform the debate about aged care policy going into the election campaign, which now looks like going to be in sort of May or June. And Bill Shorten did one of his so-called town hall meetings tonight, and amongst the issues that was raised by people was aged care on numerous occasions. I mean, it's just something that everybody has a direct interest in the sense that they know somebody who's in aged care. They're really aware of the sort of shortfalls of the system and the fact that government policy can change that. So I think it will make aged care a real election issue, even though the Royal Commission is likely to go on long after the election campaign itself has come and gone.
Which brings us to another issue the Libs are doing their best to avoid, and that's women. Mm. Resignations continue.
There's no more potent political message than your Minister for Women resigning. Kelly O'Dwyer, I think, has legitimate personal reasons to be going relating to her family. But keep in mind, this is someone who was essentially humiliated on a couple of occasions when she was sent out to defend the indefensible, including the government not calling a Banking Royal Commission, only to be further humiliated by the government announcing the exact opposite decision sometimes on the same day as she'd been defending it. And we have heard from numerous sources that she had reported back to the party that people in her electorate viewed the government as sort of anti-women, homophobic, and a range of other sort of unattractive sort of descriptors. So this is a woman who's done her best, I think, in difficult circumstances to fly the flag for the Liberal Party. But the fact that she's decided to go, a senior cabinet minister deciding to leave, is just a devastating sign. And I think given the state of the Liberal Party in Victoria, the fact that it's now pretty much controlled by some fairly radical religious groups, will make it very hard for them to come up with a credible alternative candidate. And even if they do, to run a really solid campaign to hold on to a seat, which should be completely beyond question as a Liberal seat.
I know Julie Bishop never makes a move without discussing it in detail with you. Is she going to linger on or jump ship?
Look, I think my feeling is that Julie Bishop has sort of been waiting to see how the lie of the land lies. But I think some have speculated that one of her interests is also in ensuring that that she doesn't open the door for Christian Porter, the Attorney General, to jump ship from his seat and move into her much safer seat. So the cynics think that she will leave it as late as possible before she announces that she won't recontest the election. She may decide to hold on, that she has some options if she stays in Parliament, but she's had the best job that you could possibly have from a lot of perspectives. And if she was to stay on in the vague hope that she could become opposition leader, which a lot of people in the party would oppose her for because she's not conservative enough, she'd be looking at presumably a very long period in opposition, and you'd wonder why it would be worth her while to do that.
What about the forthcoming election? And I know you're arguing that the Prime Minister will delay it as long as possible. What do you think about the timing?
What do I think about the timing? I think if they haven't gone by this weekend, they will go after the April budget, which means it'll be in the middle of May.
And this will give quite a few new names and old friends a chance. Rob Oakeshott.
Yeah, I think these three-cornered contests are going to be very interesting. I think Anthony Green, the well-known ABC election guru, is giving Rob Oakeshott a very good chance of winning Cowper, the seat that is now based sort of roughly from Port Macquarie up to Coffs Harbour. Rob Oakeshott was sort of not necessarily well regarded by a lot in the electorate after 2010, because he and a couple of other so-called country independents supported Julia Gillard to form minority government. He's put his hand up again. The long-serving member for Cowper, Luke Hartsucker, is leaving. He's getting out of politics. Rob Oakeshott, at the last election in 2016, decided very late in the piece, 3 weeks before election day, that he was going to run for the seat, and got 26% of the vote, which is pretty sort of sizable. So I think he has got a really decent chance, given this disillusion in regional Australia about whether people are actually listening to them in Canberra. And he's one of a number of people who I think will make the contest a very interesting one.
So we begin a new year with the aura of Laura. Thank you, Laura Tingle, Chief Political Correspondent for 7:30. And as promised, up next on the Little Wireless program, Jason Sharman, and he's going to talk to us about his Empires of the Week. That's WEAK, the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order. It is abundantly clear, to some painfully clear, that we're in the midst of a transition to an Asian century or even epoch. It's not just the booming powerhouse economies and militaries of India and China. It's the, what one might say, the detumescence of Western powers. Europe in disarray, the US is essentially withdrawing from the Asia-Pacific, and it's failed to win what is now, well, a nearly two-decade war in the Middle East. But how should we interpret the rise of China and India and the decline of the West? My next guest argues that what we're experiencing is, in fact, a return to the historical status quo. Jason argues that Western dominance of the global system was an anomaly, and we need to understand that in order to get a grip on our present and future. Jason Sharman, Professor of International Relations at Cambridge, the new book, as I said, Empires of the Week. An Aussie by birth, as you will hear. Jason's been with us before. His previous book was The Despot's Guide to Wealth Management, and that was about corruption in the international system. And to help us launch our new year of Late Night Lives, Jason joins me from the London studio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
One of your criticisms of how we've understood the rise of the West is that we've seen it as a story which culminates or ends with Western domination of the global system in the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a bad tendency in amongst social scientists, but also policymakers as well, to take what they believe to be the end of the story and then reinterpret all of the preceding history, really to kind of shift it, to sort it, to distort it in such a way as it becomes this rather triumphal march to what we imagine to be the end of the story, namely the Western dominance of the international system.
But as you point out, in contrast, if the end of the story is any time after decolonization or the recent resurgence of powers like China, the story becomes very different.
Indeed, the story of Western domination is probably misleading for two senses. One, of course, we don't know how the story ends, but crystal ball gazing into the 21st century, it seems at least as likely that Asian powers will be dominant rather than the continued dominance of Western powers. Secondly, it's a rather kind of potted and unreliable guide to most of the history of the last 500 years. So it's both retrospectively and prospectively not very helpful.
You point out that Western scholars have posed the question, how did Europe come to dominate the world? They've had, and I quote, an unabashed conviction that Europeans were inherently superior to other races, even though this has been discredited. Those biases linger.
Yeah, very much so. That obviously, this was previously in the form of kind of outright racist beliefs, but I think in the 20th century, there's still been a lingering belief in the technological and institutional superiority of Westerners, and which is supposedly, so the story goes, explains why to both the West to the Americas and the East to Asia, it's commonly, though mistakenly, assumed that Europeans dominated foreign policies when they ventured across the seas in the early modern period.
When did this Eurocentrism begin, in your view, Jason?
In some ways, it was always there from the start. It's probably not too surprising that each civilization has views about its own centrality and superiority. But of course, it's the ability of scholarship, both in history and the social sciences, the fact that that's come to be dominated by the West, that's meant that the Western view of international relations or history has tended to become the dominant view. And as I say, this really distorts our ability to take a clear-eyed view of what's possibly in store for us, but also to understand the big trends in history over the last five centuries.
In introducing you, I neglected to observe an ongoing tradition of the program, and that is to have the guest explain the name of the named chair, Sir Patrick Shea. You're the Patrick Shea Professor. Who is or was he?
Sir Patrick Shea is still around, and the chair was named after him. He led a policy inquiry into Britain in the early 1990s, and that's the inquiry for which he received his knighthood. So in that sense, a little bit of overlap between his inquiry into policing and some of the research I do, not so much in this book, but as you referred to earlier, to do with corruption and money laundering.
Now, in the book, you argue that we've misunderstood the West's brief tenure at the top because we overplay the importance of the military revolution that occurred in Europe in the early modern period. Take us through this argument.
Sure, this is the idea that supposedly Europe was a uniquely warlike and competitive place, and that because of this existential struggle for survival that faced European rulers, that Europeans got particularly good at waging war in two senses. First off, Europeans could invent better engines of war, particularly guns and gunpowder weapons. And secondly, that Europeans were better at inventing institutions that enabled the resource mobilization of money, of men, of all the things that it takes to fight a war, and that was namely states. So this idea that superior technology, mainly guns, and superior institutions, mainly states, made Europeans, gave Europeans a superiority in conducting warfare, that although developed in Europe for European circumstances, when these capacities were exported overseas to the Americas, to Africa and to Asia, supposedly gave Europeans an advantage, and then the story continues, explain the rise of European global empires and the subordination of civilizations outside of Europe.
But you argue that in fact that Europe did not have a technological superiority, at least in the early stage of this era.
Yeah, for most of the time that we've had an international system, which you could say is roughly 500 years since Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama, that in fact Europeans haven't had a military superiority really anywhere, including in Europe. They've been at parity, sometimes superiority, but just as much inferiority. And that in fact Europeans, when they've gone overseas, for the most of the time, did so on a basis of deferring to more powerful local civilizations. And in fact, European expansion often had more to do with European subordination than dominance.
Well, if we look at the case of the Mesoamericans, a tiny group of conquistadors arrive and in a sense use a pre-existing mythology and disease to dominate.
Yes, I mean, certainly disease was very important in the progress of the conquistadors and then the Portuguese in the Americas. But also, of course, it's a very small group of conquistadors with a very large group of local allies. So you might have a couple of hundred Spaniards, but tens of thousands of local allies amongst the American Indians there. And the second part of that story tends to get left out. So what was in some sense a local civil war with some role for a bunch of foreigners from the Iberian Peninsula becomes transformed into a story of tiny groups of Europeans overcoming huge forces of Americans. Again, not really the story.
Talking to Jason Sharman about Empires of the Week, the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order. An old friend of mine and of the program is Simon Winchester, and by eerie coincidence, I've just been rereading one of his masterpieces, The Man That Loved China, which reminds us, Jason, of the technological dazzlements that the Chinese have historically produced.
Exactly. Starting off, of course, with gunpowder, that for a long time European scholars were pretty reluctant to admit the fact that the Chinese, not Europeans, had invented both gunpowder and gunpowder weapons. And in some ways, it's the progress of Europe from around about 1500 was really catching up with things that in many cases the Chinese had done first 500 years earlier. And so what we like to think of as a process of westernization, in some ways and in military terms, is in fact a belated process of Sinification. As Europe came to replicate advances earlier made in China.
You say there definitely were massive military innovations in Europe, however. For example, tactical change came about with Dutch reformers adapting a classic Roman linear battlefield formation.
That's true. There were big changes in the way that the Europeans fought wars after the end of the medieval period, partly to do with changing technology. But if we look at the implications of this for the wider world, the kind of disjuncture or the fly in the ointment for the conventional story is that Europeans fought wars in Europe very differently from the way that they engaged in their expeditions and conquest outside Europe. And in fact, the big advances in Europe, tactical and the size of arms, armies and institutional progress in terms of states. If we look at what Europeans were doing in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, it was tiny groups of Europeans, generally kind of freelancers or operating on a semi-private basis, and using almost none of the tactics and strategies that characterized war in Europe at the same time.
Clearly, Europe managed to convince itself not only of its racial superiority, but also its technological superiority. We also did a pretty good demolition job, did we not, on convincing, at least for some time, convincing the Chinese that they were pretty much a subject or a spent force.
That's true. That was certainly a great time of soul searching during the so-called century of humiliation for China. Of course, the Chinese had a pretty good line themselves in thinking that they were the center of the world and superior to all of the barbarian civilizations that surrounded them. So in that sense, just like there's Eurocentrism, there's Sinocentrism too.
But of course, that conviction, that inner belief in the Middle Kingdom and of Chinese centrality is now coming back to the fore.
That's right. So we obviously have the return of China, particularly with the fantastic growth rates of the Chinese economy since 1978, and the more particular rise of Xi Jinping since December 2012. But in some ways, I mean, China underrates its achievements. China's an empire too. Just like the Europeans went to other places and conquered them, so too did the Chinese. But in some ways, the Chinese empire lasts today. Although for all the things that the Chinese government likes to talk about in terms of national achievements, perhaps coercive empire building is one of the ones that gets less play than it should.
You also attack the idea that Europeans perfected modern warfare because they were constantly fighting each other. And in doing so, they were honing their skills in a kind of Darwinian struggle for dominance.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of a common assumption, not just in warfare, but in lots of things, that practice makes perfect, that organizations learn to do what they do better through a process of either learning or elimination. This kind of view of survival of the fittest, or at least survival of the smartest. And I think that's actually a pretty misleading guide to what either armies or most other sorts of organizations do.
So you would suggest that this idea that strong organizations will dominate weaker ones is a bit delusional.
Yeah, I think it seems perfectly common sense when you first think about it. But the more reflection, I think the more difficult it becomes to hold these views. And one is that, well, in order to find out how you can make your organization more efficient, and that might be an army or that might be a government or a company or a university, you really have to know what causes what in the social world. And that's, in fact, extremely difficult. Secondly, even if you do figure out what causes what, then you have to be able to reform your organization, and that's usually, again, incredibly difficult.
Jason, in your studies on finance and business systems, do you see a Darwinian triumph there?
No, not at all. That it's instead organizations seem to be prone to fashions and fads, to herding behavior. And organizations, whether they're in the military sphere or the financial sphere, are instead more likely to be swayed as what's seen as legitimate or appropriate, rather than efficiency or effectiveness determining either what they do or how they structure themselves.
What about this idea of adaption, that Europeans were learning from the mistakes and adapting better and stronger, armies in particular?
Well, I think that again, I'm a subscriber to the nobody knows anything school of social inference or causal inference there. I mean, it's all very well to know that you lost a battle, for example, but it's entirely another matter to work out why you lost that battle. There could be lots of reasons: bad logistics, bad morale, bad leadership, bad technology. Maybe the opponent was just overwhelming superior. Maybe it was a fluke. Even if you can answer all of those questions, though, with perfect certainty, there's a difference between knowing what has to be done and being able to do it. So, for example, if you're the president of Iraq or Afghanistan now, you would probably think that your army would work a lot better if your regime weren't corrupt. But, of course, knowing that you have to reduce corruption in your government is very much easier to say that than to do it.
You are a heretic. You argue that leaders and managers at any given organization, the military, a university, perhaps even here at the ABC, rarely actually know what they're doing. In other words, nobody knows anything.
Yes, that's pretty much true. I'm sure the ABC is an exception, but for most other organizations, most of the time, I think that's true.
Do you observe it in universities?
Well, modesty forbids.
Cambridge,
Cambridge, except Cambridge accepted, of course, but yes, I think in most of us for everyday life, we can see that people moan about bureaucracy, moan about committee meetings, moan about all sorts of other dysfunctions in the workplace, and yet they always seem to be there. We structure and restructure, we hire management consultants, and yet 2-3 years down the track, we've got to restructure in a different way, or we've got to get some more management consultants, we've got to have more committee meetings about how to reduce the number of committee meetings we're all going to. So it's much more a theatre of the absurd view of the way that organisations do their business, rather
organisational life, it's a bit more like a Dilbert cartoon or an episode of The Office than it is like a sublime management text.
Exactly. It's not really McKinsey. It's much more Dilbert there.
Okay. What are some of the examples of weak states surviving past their, long past their use-by date?
Well, we can look at all of the tiny states in the world that, if you think that there are about 40 states that have a population of under a million, there are about 15 states that have a population of about of under 100,000, many of them in Australia's Pacific neighbourhood. We can think that about 35 states just don't have any armed forces at all. And we can think that places like Andorra and
Liechtenstein. You're talking about micro-states like Andorra,
yeah, sure.
Liechtenstein.
Yeah, exactly, that survived the Second World War unscathed at times when, that you have obviously many states being conquered, destroyed, or at least severely damaged. So there's really no correlation between the strength of states in terms of their economy or their military and the likelihood that they'll survive the rigors of the international system or international war.
You talk also about the later Ottoman Empire lingering on, past its use-by date.
Yeah, again, there's this teleology whereby the end of the story, quote-unquote, for Europeans is success. So it's the story of culminating success. The so-called end of the story for non-Western powers, the Ottomans, the Mughals, the various Chinese empires, is supposedly one of failure. After all, we overlook the fact that the Ottomans were around for a long time, 500 years, longer than the British Empire, and still, even in their last decade, were, of course, strong enough to be militarily effective, not least in turning back the Anzac landings.
Would you be kind enough to tell us about bulletproofing in the way you use the term?
Sure. So I look at an extreme example of where in Africa, but also in other places for many centuries, combatants have had the belief that if they drink certain magic potions or wear magic amulets, that they can become immune to bullets and therefore, of course, a lot more potent in battle. Now, of course, we know that this is not actually true, but for my purposes, the really astounding thing is if there were any belief that are militarily ineffective and, of course, downright dangerous, that we would expect to be eliminated through learning or through the fact of being shot, it would be this one. And yet, this strong cultural presumption in the power of magical bulletproofing not only has survived for long historical periods, but indeed in some parts of the world survives today.
Well, we saw it in Uganda, didn't we, in 86?
Indeed, there are many insurgencies historically in the 20th century and into the 21st century. And the example in Uganda of people thinking they could cover themselves with certain substances, march forward nearly naked in a long line, chanting certain psalms, but also chanting James Bond and hoping that the Holy Spirit, which supposedly was in command of their army, would not only safeguard them from their opponent's fire, but also, of course, bring the victory in battle.
Do you think Donald Trump sometimes thinks he's bulletproof?
It's hard to tell what's going on there, but indeed, there do seem to be beliefs that are radically divorced from reality.
LNL on RN, our first live program for the new year, and my guest is Jason Sharman. Jason is Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge, which, of course, like the ABC, is impervious to error. The book we're discussing is his Empires of the Weak, the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order. I mentioned very much earlier in the program the conquistadors in the Americas. Are there other parallels more recent to that idea of overwhelming a vulnerable society?
Well, I think that certainly in the 19th century, particularly the late 19th century, this is in some ways the exception. The Europeans really were dominant, particularly in conquering Africa in the late 19th century, in cowing previously very powerful states in Asia, China and Japan. But even there, you can think, well, in some sense, why did the Europeans really want to do this? It's regarded as commonplace that that states have this innate drive, empire, for expansion across the seas. But again, rather than this being something that's natural and universal, it is rather peculiar to Western states. And again, if you look at the payoff for them in terms of building empires, it's much less clear in either economic or security terms than you might at first think.
We know that the sun never set on the British Empire, but you point out that there wasn't really an inevitability about Britain's rise, or indeed about the Dutch. And take the East India Company. It didn't start off as a centrally planned project.
No, that the Dutch and the British East India Companies were very much kind of ad hoc expedients. You had ambitious governments in Europe that didn't really have the money or the men to construct overseas colonies. So they embarked on what we now might call a public-private partnership of endowing these for-profit private institutions with all sorts of powers that we now associate with states, not least, of course, the power to build armies and navies, to conquer places and engage in international diplomacy, and indeed they went forth and did this.
Jason, one of your big criticisms is directed at fellow academics who've written the history. You argue that there is a very implicit bias in the assumptions made by historians and international relations scholars. They hang on to their illusions and delusions.
Well, that might be putting it slightly harshly, but certainly I think that they've mistaken both the evidence and that there are these strong presumptions in terms of rational, efficient institutions that really don't hold up and that are misleading if we're trying to understand the present or the past, or if we're trying to gaze into the crystal ball and look what's ahead as well.
So you reckon empire wasn't necessarily a successful endeavour for the colonial powers, that they didn't necessarily get their money's worth?
No, I think far from it. In most cases, it was a rather loss-making prestige project that was to do with not so much military insecurity but cultural insecurity, whereby empire was seen as the marker of a great power. In order to be regarded as a great power, particularly those late on the stage, like unified Germany, unified Italy or Japan, was regarded to really prove your mettle as a great power. You had to have an empire, perhaps in the same way that now, to be a genuine great power, it's regarded that you have to have nuclear weapons.
The empire, okay. You say the West's heyday. Even then, you could see the seeds of its decline. And I guess one of the biggest came along with the use of guerrilla armies.
Exactly. It's commonplace now, but even at the time when the West was being most successful, say already from the beginning of the 20th century, there were precursors of what was to come, as even if the West was winning in places like South Africa in the Boer War or in the interwar period in North Africa with the French and Spanish, that it was becoming increasingly difficult, that European powers were having to mobilize hundreds of thousands of troops in a way that's familiar from the failed counterinsurgency campaigns that we saw during decolonization in the few decades after the Second World War, but also, of course, is familiar to us now from recent experience from Iraq and Afghanistan.
What could Australian policymakers learn from your book in terms of our place in Asia?
Well, I think first off that if the 21st century is to be an Asian century, and who knows, social scientists are lousy at predictions, that in fact this is not so much unprecedented, this is not uncharted territory, but in fact is a return to the norm. And in fact, for most of the time, we've had international relations across different civilizations. Western civilization has been at best at parity and sometimes at inferiority. So in fact, we're going back to the normal state of affairs. And we shouldn't really be that surprised if we had, in broad historical terms, a brief anomalous period of Western superiority.
And should we be afraid, or should we be a bit more relaxed about the changing power reality?
I think we shouldn't really be that afraid, at least only we should be afraid only to the extent our conception of self is wrapped up with this idea of natural, inevitable Western superiority. I think that, you know, if we have that, we're going to be disillusioned sooner or later. I think this is not only factually wrong, but it's also very misleading as a guide to policy as to what we should do, but also what we are.
So, in summary, ladies and gentlemen, victory does not always go to those with the most advanced technology, the largest armies, and the most developed state apparatus. Thank you very much, Jason. Jason Sharman's book is called Empires of the Weak. Not Empire of the Weak, Empires of the WEAK. It's the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order. And for some reason that I never understand, it's not published by Cambridge, but by Princeton University Press. Well, we're back, and it's great to be back. And, of course, all our regulars will fall into place, which means that on our next, we'll have Bruce Shapiro telling us what's been going on in the US since we last spoke. Something must have been going on. And I'll be talking to journalist Molly Ball about Nancy Pelosi. Her own daughter says of her mum, she'll cut your head off and you won't even know you're bleeding. That's all you need to know about her. No one has ever won betting against Nancy Pelosi. She's persevered. This is a story I'm very anxious to do because Pelosi is now arguably the most powerful woman on earth. And we'll also be talking to Carl Onair, who wrote the bestseller In Praise of Slow. And we'll be talking about his new book, Bolder, on how perceptions of aging are changing. Well, I hope so. That's your lot. We'll see you later.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.